I have to tell the people about the Patreon.
Yes, you do. Patreon.com/SMDB. SMDB, like so many damn books.
For just a dollar, you can join up and you get access to all the exclusive content that I record just for the Patreon. Also, you get to join the book club. Oh, there's so many damn books book club. It's been some of the best conversations I've had about books.
It really always sounds like a blast. I'll usually like come home and just hear like giggles coming from the library. So it's a great time. You should join.
And I would love to have more people join the fray.
You may or may not know that Christopher runs this whole show himself on the hosting side, on the technical side, everything. This is a one-man show, truly. He does it all. Support your boy, Christopher.
Even at the dollar level really helps. So join up. Patreon.com/SMDB. I'd love to have you.
Patreon.com/SMDB.
On with the show. Good morning, Drew.
Morning, Christopher.
Welcome to So Many Damn Books.
So many.
So many.
So many damn books.
And now I welcome you here. Chin Chin. I have, do you have caffeine?
Yes.
Is that just grain alcohol?
No, it's hydrant, which is one of those like powders you stir into a thing and it's 100 milligrams of caffeine and makes your water more hydrating, you know, because that's real.
Yo, this, I'm sticking a pin in this to come back to in the recommendations section because I have thoughts.
Okay.
But anyway, so is it good? Is it more watery or something?
It's so much more watery, Drew. It's just the most water you've ever watered.
And this is hydrant, like spelled like the fire hydrant that my dog pees on.
They're not paying us, man. We don't need to.
Well, I don't know. I figured we could try it.
They could, if they wanted to pay us, they could.
They certainly could. We're here. We're available. You can write to us at somanydamnbooks@gmail.com. And preferably just put, you don't have to put the figure, but you can put the number of zeros into the subject line. That's true for anybody too. If you, I don't know, if you're a
So Many Damn Books is for sale.
A recently divorced billionaire looking to offload some change, you know,
are you saying Bill Gates should give us some money for fun?
No, I was thinking Melinda.
Oh, yeah.
Or Mackenzie Bezos. You know, the readers of the... I guess Gates is a reader.
Allegedly.
Allegedly.
He probably has a robot read it to him like a jerk.
Can you even imagine? Somebody's like, I'm too smart for this. And there's just like a robot sitting next to him, like reading in a monotone. Marley was dead to begin with.
Is that a Marley and Me?
Yeah, that's how that book famously starts, right?
Marley dying.
Oh,
it's either Marley and Me or Charles Dickens.
Yeah.
The classic dichotomy.
It's like Quirk should publish that when you know how they were doing all those mashups, the Pride and Prejudice and Zombies and stuff. A Christmas Carol mashed up with Marley and Me.
So Mostly a Christmas story. That just the visit from Marley is the dog.
And I think it's great.
But he can't tell him like that three, you know, spooks are coming. He's just barking.
He's
at
just
him.
Like, what are you trying to tell me, boy?
I would read this.
Yeah, I think it's a great idea.
I'm excited to talk to you about, we're going to talk Highsmith today. We're going to talk Ripley.
The Ripleys.
And I'm very excited to talk to you about that.
I'm excited too. It's been a long time coming.
I know I'm not drinking this right now because it's Sunday in the morning, but I did make up a drink.
Ooh.
I'm calling it the Ripley Gimlet.
Hell yeah.
Because nothing is as it seems. It may be called a gimlet,
Uh-huh.
But it's actually a daiquiri. And it's not even, well, I mean, gimlets are actually daiquiris if you believe the cocktail codex writers, but regardless. So there's this great, Dram puts out this great, it's gin without the juniper. It's this alcohol called Esquibac, which has like cardaway and cardamom and nutmeg, and it's colored with a little bit of saffron. It's absolutely delicious. And so I'm using that as the base alcohol, and then chamomile simple syrup, half an ounce of that, and then half an ounce of your own sort of sour mix. And so I mixed lime, lemon, and orange all together. And so you can mess with those proportions at home. But those three things, shaken with ice, double strain, so it's really, really, you know, easy drinking. So yeah, nothing is as it seems in the Ripley Gimlet. And it's very, I think it's one of those drinks that like opens up to you. The more you sip it, by the end, you're just like, yes, another.
Nice.
Which is also how you feel after reading a Ripley book sometimes, depending. I don't know. Did you, we'll see if you liked it.
I did, but it, in a complicated way, which I feel like is appropriate.
Yes.
For the books at hand.
And the drink, which is a complicated drink.
I just was looking it up. Esquibac. This is very cool looking.
Oh, it's a really cool looking bottle too. It's a nice, yeah. It's a nice thing to have on your shelf. Dram makes a lot of nice stuff.
Cool.
I mean, if we're going for sponsorships, really, I would like Dram to be the one.
We can dream, right?
Yeah. So we should talk about buying things.
Yes.
What did you buy?
So it's two things that I've gotten sent recently. One of them is a debut novel called Mona at Sea by Elizabeth Gonzalez James. And it's a millennial perfectionist graduating into the teeth of the recession in 2008, which I certainly commiserate with. But it sounds like another like funny, wry, deeply meaningful millennial trying to make it novel, which I feel like I'm not yet anywhere near tired of. I kind of thought that maybe I would be because I don't know, I lived it and continue to live it. But I'm always, whenever I get a pitch like that, I'm always like, yeah, I'll take a look at this. So I'm excited to read that. And then I got a UK proof, which I always love to get. It's just full of the back and front cover are full of quotes, which I think that's a really cool, neat thing to do, particularly for a debut. The novel is called Open Water by Caleb Azuma Nelson. And one of my new part-time gigs is doing some events for this organization called Jericho Writers in the UK. And the like headlining first summer festival writer conversation that actually I'm not even hosting it. I'll just be in the chat, but is with Caleb. And the publicist was emailing the staff. And I was like, I mean, I'd like a copy, but you can just send me a PDF. It's okay. And the very sweet publicist was like, hell no, I'm going to send you a copy of the book. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, it came in like an air post. And I was just like, ooh, yes, a British book. So I'm excited to read that too.
You got to eat some sort of British candy or like have some clotted cream on a...
They're too far away and I'm too tied up in cables, but I have some lemon pasties that I think will be perfect. A little tin of them that I got
there you go.
At my local grocery store. Why they had those? Who knows?
Who knows?
What do you got?
Yeah, I got two things that I'm very, very excited about. Book recommender extraordinaire Nosley has been making snacking cakes on her Instagram.
Oh yeah.
And so I had, and they look amazing. And the idea of a snacking cake is that one, it's really simple to make. And two, it's, you know, you just, every time you pass by it, you take a little inch of the snacking cake. And so it's one bowl. Almost all the cakes are just like, as like, you know, wet ingredients first, then dry, then bake, like very, very simple. And so it's Snacking Cakes is the name of it.
Cool.
Yossi Arefi wrote it, and 50 cakes. I'm really excited to make some snacking cakes. I feel like it's going to be the thing to do this summer, is like, just bring one of those to the park.
Ooh, yeah. Good idea.
Have a nice sweet picnic. And then
cool.
I'm really, I actually exclaimed with glee when I opened this box that came, because we got sent the new Maggie Nelson, On Freedom, Four Songs of Care and Constraint. And of course, we are Maggie Nelson super fans on the show. We got to talk to Stephanie Dandler about Bluettes, and we've talked about the Argonauts in the past. And so I'm very, very excited to read this new one. It comes out in September. So pre-order it, because pre-orders mean the world.
Yes.
Mean the world to people. But I cannot wait to read what she's up to. I mean, I don't know one lick about this book, but I'm very excited to be back in Maggie Nelson's sentences.
Yeah, it should be fun. I too, I'm trying to not know anything about it other than the title, and then I will sit down to read it and be pleasantly surprised.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can't wait.
This has truly been a long time coming.
We've talked Highsmith on the show so much.
Mm-hmm. What was the first? It was my first Highsmith was Deep Water, when Megan Abbott came on the show.
That's right.
One of the times that Megan came on the show. And I remember like that was a big moment. Because you, even at that point, were well into your Highsmithing.
Yeah, I was brought to Highsmith by I had a grad school class that was just looking at first chapters of books, and looking at like what you can learn from reading a first chapter, and what sort of books get set up in what ways. And so we read the first chapter to Ripley and the first chapter to Strangers on a Train. And
cool.
It was a really exciting, strange way of looking at books. But both of those first chapters are so impressive and alluring and exciting that it's like, oh yeah, like I understand completely why, you know, I wanted to read more. And so I read that first Talented Mr. Ripley, and like halfway through it, I stopped, ordered the next four online. And because I knew, I was just like, I want to read that. And they all came, and I read them all, five Ripleys, over a weekend.
Nice. Yeah, I mean, the beginning of The Talented Mr. Ripley is fucking phenomenal. It throws you in a way that it, like, you can't not keep reading.
Yeah.
You know, as he's like ducking into a bar because he's maybe running away from somebody, like, and then he's like in the bar, quickly moving through the moments in his head of like, okay, what can I do? How do I get out of this? How can I pretend that I've been here? Just that it, from like a craft standpoint, it asks so many questions, but they're all delivered with such a barb in the hook that you're like, yeah, well, I have to see what this guy's deal is.
I don't pretend to think that he was the first of these, but he's certainly one of the most memorable of the charming sociopath. You can't help but root for them, but you're also rooting for them to get caught, but you also want them to get away. And I feel like so many characters since are somewhat in the Ripley mold.
Mm-hmm.
Looking at someone like Dexter.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean Dexter the serial killer, not the small
child in the laboratory.
Yeah. or even Don Draper on Mad Men. I feel like there's these people who are like charming, and they can kind of become another person, and you're sort of rooting for them to get away with that. It's an exciting sort of person to be with.
Yeah. It's funny too, because I think that I can't think of another anti-hero, charming sociopath, however you want to describe him, who is as kind of as like unmitigatedly a pain in the ass as Ripley is. Like even Don Draper, he has these moments where specifically there's like the charm is layered in. Mm-hmm. Whereas like Ripley is truly has the like almost the psychopath thing. Like there is sort of a very cold underneath with Ripley that is, if anything, it's even more impressive of an accomplishment to write that character and make you root for him in a way that I feel like Patrick Bateman, like all of the more intense, more macabre versions of Ripley who've been written over the decades, it's almost like at some point the author couldn't really go all the way and truly write the stone cold iteration of it. Because how can you outdo what Highsmith did?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, and especially because she wrote sequels, you know, they have that sequelitis thing of bigger, mm-hmm. better, bigger crimes, crazier circumstances. There's a later entry in the series, Ripley's Game, where he mm-hmm. like basically tries to get someone else to murder someone for him just because he's like, that sounds like a fun weekend, you know, like. I think also, you know, I sense a lot of Donna Tartt has taken a lot of the lessons of Ripley and put them in her novels, because it's that same sort of like, I don't know, you want them to continue because you love the aesthetic, like, and Ripley's drawn to aesthetic in the same way that Richard Pepin is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and like, the way that the books almost have a formula to them. It's not quite, but it is a little bit of like, we're introduced to Ripley at some stage in his life. Then we're introduced to whatever sort of nefarious thing he's up to, whether that's like art forgery, dealing with the mafia, some kid came along, like each of these things. And then it's like, now let's, like, that's, I don't know, almost half the novel sometimes, where it's just like, he's doing something sketchy, you know, at some point somebody's gonna die.
Mm-hmm.
Death happens, and then Ripley's like, how am I gonna get out of this one? And there is a little bit of that, like, you're there both for the pleasures of the storytelling, but also for sort of that, like, that meta pleasure of, ooh, she's put him into this trap. How's he gonna, like, and we know he's gonna get out of the trap. And so how is he gonna do it? I never felt concerned that he was going to get caught. And I think that's the thing that I found most difficult about, like, because there is, I was looking for more of a moral delivery, like the moral arc of the universe bending towards justice thing.
Right.
And I never doubted for a second that he was going to get away with everything.
Right. It's the series problem. It's like, it's the Batman mm-hmm. problem. Like, Batman will never die unless it's like the end of that Batman run.
Right. Right.
And in so many ways, Ripley is a superhero.
Yeah.
Or supervillain, or because he's always one step ahead or has another idea or is strangely competent at this thing that he needs to be competent with. And you know, the main one is just his ability to mimic.
Yeah.
You know, his ability in the first one to become Dickie Greenleaf to a ridiculous extent
mm-hmm.
is his superpower. And then you see that superpower sort of get applied to different situations, even like cross-dressing in Berlin in the later installments.
Yeah. It's it reminded me a lot of the way that we think about Sherlock Holmes now too. Like, Holmes as sort of the master mimic. You play it in the movies or in the show where Watson's like, I thought I was talking to this old beggar. And then he took off his nose and it was Holmes. Oh my God. There's a bit like, there's that thing about Ripley where he's so able to, I don't know, but to do it in a way that doesn't feel as showy as Holmes, where Holmes is like master of makeup and disguise and stuff. Ripley's like, I put a little bit of lemon juice in my hair and I combed it a different way. And ta-da, I'm Dickie Greenleaf. And it's like, how?
Right.
But the way that everybody falls for it, yeah, it does feel like a superpower.
Well, and also in the way of, it's like a little bit of fantasy fulfillment of like, because like not only does he get away with it, but he gets like, I don't know, just like a bunch of money from Dickie's parents and like lives off of his trust fund. And you're just, and as that's happening, you're just like, ah, Ripley, you cad. But you know, like you feel that he's getting away with something in the way that you want like the Ocean's 11 crew to get away with it. Like, because it's just like, well, they don't like whoever he's scamming is a fool. Like their money, they're usually rich people. So you don't feel that bad about them losing their money. It's to a murderous sociopath, sure, but but a fool and their money are soon parted, damn it.
Right.
One of the real big pleasures for me of these novels is just the phone life of like pay phones, hotel phones, leaving a message at a hotel desk at a or just like everyone knows that John's at the bar at this hour. Like there's always
And they like call the bar. Oh my God.
And the guys amazing. They look around for that guy and there's just always like weird phone stuff that is that could never happen now because we all carry our phones. And I think it's one of those things that really dates it and really makes you feel like you're in a vintage paperback.
Yeah. Yeah, big time. So, in a way that like someday people will look back at novels written right now and be like, there will be something about the ways in which we are communicating, even like early cell phone novels where people are calling versus novels that are coming out now where people are texting.
Right. Or,
you know,
I was reading a book that like was really working with MySpace, you know, so.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I like that, man. I like living in that time period.
Me too.
You know,
I think it's disingenuous when an author will not use it. Like they seem to like write around it.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. One thing that I found really interesting reading it from the point of view of 2021, the way in which Highsmith is thoroughly unbothered by the way that the novels move through time, or at least that was how, like the first novel is written in 1990 or 1955, I think. And the second one is like 20 years later, or 15 years later, but the jump in time doesn't quite match, but she's just like, she's talking about, it's like, ah, it's the 60s or whatever in a way that's like, hang on, it's only been like 3 or 4 years, hasn't it? And the way that, I hated that I noticed it, and it, in the way that like I think the final Ripley book was written in like 95 or something. So the five books come out over 40-ish years. Ripley moves through to like he's not in the 90s in that last book, but there's definitely a sense that like he's further ahead in time than the chronology. If it was being written today, an editor would be like, no, you have to make sure, like you said that it was 5 years since this thing, but this sociopolitical thing doesn't happen until 3 years after that, in a way that like it just doesn't matter. It doesn't matter to the enjoyment of the books. Clearly it didn't matter to Highsmith, in a really like, I don't know, a pleasant throwback almost.
Yeah.
To being in a place where it's like, the point is not that these five novels hang together and that you can linearly chart each thing and be like, ah, it was 3 years here, 6 months here. That's not the point. Like the point is the specific pleasures of each discrete installment. I think it's that, like you said, Batman too, that like the comic book thing where the discrete installment is the joy, mm-hmm. not the overarching combined universe of it.
Did you read them all basically one after another?
It was brutal, to be honest. Like, it is both pleasurable and kind of not. Like, it's kind of painful to watch, to be in his head.
Yeah.
I think it's that. Like, he's not, for as charming as he is, I think because we sort of get to see, unlike anybody in his life, we get to see through the veneer. And because I know enough about Highsmith as a person and know that she sounds like she was not a tremendously pleasant character.
Oh no, she seems like a real horrible person.
Yeah. And so there's a bit of that where you're just like, yeah, I'm going to keep reading, but like, I need to take a shower. Like, ugh.
Yeah. That voice is difficult. And that she's so, you know, Highsmith really felt like she was putting herself on the page with mm-hmm. Ripley. There's a story where she used to sometimes sign books as Ripley and then cross it out and then write Patricia Highsmith underneath, which that's funny and also so alarming.
Yeah. The likelihood that she murdered somebody feels more like more than a 50% chance at some point in her life and got away with it and was like, wow. You know,
I've tried to read 2 biographies of her and I've given up both times because it just turned out like, I don't really want to know that much more about her. I just want to read her books. And there's enough of those.
Yeah. I have that anecdote about her at the party with like the snail in her bag.
Yeah. That was her guest that she brought a head of lettuce covered in snails to the party.
And it's like, there's that thing where if you don't know anything else about her other than that she's an author, it's like, oh, what a cute, charming quirk. Mm-hmm. And then you read, honest to God, like a paragraph of her writing. And it's like, oh, you are a horrifying person. Mm-hmm. I absolutely would run the other direction as soon as you walked into a party. Because I just would be like, I just have this image of her like talking to the snails or something and everybody just kind of being like, okay.
Yeah.
I think somebody needs ice in the kitchen and just like, you know.
Well, and her description of how parties work is always people trying to like extricate themselves away from the person, like from Tom or from the person that he's, you know, using for his nefarious scheme.
Right. You know what I was thinking about? Carmen Maria Machado just tweeted that she had just reread The Talented Mr. Ripley. And she was like, how could anybody stand up in the 50s because of how much they drink? And they're like, he's like, takes a disco nap, wakes up at 11 and has like another pitcher of martinis.
Yeah. But at the same time, those martinis, the glasses have gotten bigger.
Mm-hmm.
So like
mm-hmm.
the 3 martini lunch or whatever that people talked about, those were not 2.5 ounces of liquor martinis. They were like a 1/2 ounce of liquor with like so much water from like stirring with ice or shaking with ice. I do feel like they were making their drinks far less strong. But yeah, also still though, there's so much alcohol.
Everybody's drunk all the time.
Maybe that's the also part of the fantasy fulfillment of just like, wouldn't it be nice to just always have a pitcher of martinis around?
I also wonder how much of that contributes to people being like, oh, it's sticky. And it's like, and Tom's like, yes, it's me, Dicky. And everybody's like, yeah, Dicky!
Have another drink. I am Dicky Greenlee.
Yeah, exactly.
Let me freshen your glass. By the way, call me Dicky Greenlee.
And they're like, oh, okay, Tom. I mean, Dicky, you know?
Yeah, I guess if the people are drunk enough, they'll believe anything. Yeah. You believe that at magic shows, you believe that when you're about to be killed by Tom Ripley. mean, there is something that happens though in the later books. They do, his other stuff catches up with him. It's not,
yeah,
which is also one of the really interesting things about reading the series and why you might not like to read like just the fourth one.
Mm-hmm.
Because like suddenly
the fourth one really like
really leans back on everything that happened in book one. And it's like, it's sort of funny because it faints in one direction, like, oh, it's going to be about this, but it's like, nope, there's, it's really going to be about like everything that he's done so far having a fallout.
And even still, like, it doesn't even feel like the kind of like, oh, spoiler. It's just like, and then he wriggles out of it, and like the uncomfortable pleasure is in watching the wriggle. Mm-hmm. You know,
I feel like people have tried to make, you know, Highsmith-esque is something that people like to compare authors to now. I read that book, Social Creature, by Tara Isabella Burton, that was sort of trying to gender flip and but bring into the 21st century the sort of sociopath who you're sort of charmed by. And it doesn't, it didn't, it was nearly there. And there's so many things that I'm, that is close to doing all the things that the Highsmith novels do, but they're always, there's something, I don't know what it is. Do you, and now that you've read all of them, do you know what I mean?
I do. I mean, I think it is, I think it's the unflinchingness. I think that it's really hard if you yourself are not a borderline sociopath. I think it's really hard to write that, to write in that mindset and not deliver some amount of humanity or so. Like, I've been thinking a lot about American Psycho and Patrick Bateman and how Bret Easton Ellis, it turns out, is like, oh yeah, kind of a borderline sociopath. But that even that book, there's no heart in Bateman, certainly, but there's heart in the book in a way.
Okay.
That like, that I feel like in all five of the Ripley books in particular, and I don't really know if I felt this way about Deep Water, or if I would feel this way about her other books. Like, I don't know if it's because of Ripley, but it feels like when you burrow down, it's just, it's turtles all the way down. It's like cold, icy, unsparing all the way down in a way that I think is just really, really tough to pull off if you yourself don't view the world that way.
Yeah. I mean, part of it, part of the reason why it works for Highsmith is that they're just so taut. They're so tight. They're so short. Mm-hmm. I mean, they're, when I got my copies, I ordered a bunch of used 70s paperbacks, and they're those perfect slim pocket sized novels. And it's really the type of thing where, I mean, I think when I was deep into my Highsmith obsession, I would take like three on vacation and just like pull off one and go to the next one. And I've seen that in novels since, of a writer using, reading particularly Patricia Highsmith novels in that order. I've seen it more than once, which is so strange.
Yeah.
It's become a shorthand, which is so, so strange.
And I do think it's because there's nothing else. Nobody has done it better, but nobody has even necessarily done it the same since. It's like, it's a very specific thing that I think, you know, it deserves the shorthand in a way. Like, the shorthand actually matches up to the caliber of the product in a way that sometimes you're like, oh, okay, you're just like, you're trying to bridge a gap in my mind or like make me think about this thing by referencing a potentially superior product. Whereas like, this is really like, no, there's a particular vibe that I need you to understand. And that vibe comes only in the world from these books.
Mm-hmm.
And how often can you say that? Do you, I was thinking about this when I got to the end of the fifth book and had that sense of like, you know, it didn't, Ripley's story didn't feel done really, but it got me thinking about whether or not someday we might see Ripley come back to the page in the way that like James Bond has come back to the page. Oh. Sherlock Holmes is like
the way that who was it? Ewan Colfer finished the Douglas Adams series.
Yeah. Yeah. I just, you know, it like it feels like a character, you know, I could like where they're like, here, Gillian Flynn, do you want a gajillion dollars to write a Ripley novel?
Yeah, I mean, it would have to be her or Donna Tartt.
Yeah.
I can't really picture anybody else doing it, but maybe Donna Tartt would like it because it could, you know, it could be an in-between project for her.
Yeah, she's just like, oh, I cracked this out over the weekend. It just kind of felt too easy. She's got, no, you know what it is? She's been publishing Ripley fan fiction on the internet for years and nobody knows.
Yeah. And then she just changed all the names to all the characters in Secret History. What Secret History is actually four Ripley fan fiction novels that she repurposed.
Yeah, I mean, based it together.
And it is, I mean, it's funny that you're thinking of Patrick Bateman because it is dead. Secret History is dedicated to Bret Easton Ellis. So they're connected. These worlds.
It's the Bennington connection.
Ah, Bennington. So are you glad that you took the Ripley ad journey?
I am. I don't think I'll be returning to Patricia Highsmith for a long minute because I feel like I'm like, ooh.
Yeah. Five in a row is probably enough.
Yeah. But also I'm like, God, I really got to read Strangers on a Train. I love the film adaptation. It's one of my favorite Hitchcock movies.
Yeah.
You know, and there is something pleasing to the like, the reliable pleasures of, I use pleasures loosely in this case, but to be able to be like, I know I can go pick up a Highsmith at any time and get exactly what I'm expecting.
Yeah. I guess we can say, you know, we can recommend the Highsmith experience, especially if you're drawn to it. If you've been like kind of interested, but you haven't taken the leap, go for it. I think Talented Mr. Ripley is really the best Highsmith to start with.
Yeah, I would agree. It's just like, it's everything firing on all cylinders. And if you get to the end and you don't like it, you've also still got that particular, like you've got the best one kind of.
Yeah, yeah.
So speaking of diving into older classic things that one of the two of us haven't read, as we shift into recommendations, I have some inside scoop here.
Yeah.
According to my notes. Do you want to get us started?
Oh yeah. My wife bought a really beautiful copy of Dune. That really gorgeous one that's flocked with blue and it's a real foil shiny cover. And I've had that copy of Dune on my shelf, the one that everyone has, the paperback, the black paperback with the Dune on the cover for so long. And I've like looked into it and it's just blocks of text. Like it was so intimidating. Mm-hmm. And then also knowing that like people are like, yeah, none of the rest of them are very good. And the first one made into a terrible movie that, you know, that people like, you know, it's a cult classic, but people also really dislike it. So there's just so much stuff about the Dune world that just seems like it wasn't going to be for me. But this gorgeous copy and, you know, Sarah's a big fan. And so I was like, okay, I'm going to do it. And I think there was like this early moment where someone is wearing a cape for the world, and the way that he wears the cape, people are like, what a stupid idiot. Like, he's not wearing that cape right. He's obviously never worn a cape before. That's so dumb. And I immediately like got into it because there's this internal logic of how the fashion works, how the science works. That mm-hmm. was just, and it's so strange too, because it's really alien, but then there's still like palm trees and, you know, like there's still remnants of the world that I understand as a human, even though Earth is nowhere to be found in these books, or at least or in this book. I totally fell into it. I really, the strange combat style and mm-hmm. the way that time moves in them. I was just completely swept away, which
hell yeah.
I was completely surprised by. And I also am very excited about the new movie adaptation that's coming our way with Timothy Chalamet. And
that I think is only going to be the first half of
you're kidding me
the book. Yeah.
That makes me less excited.
Well, it was the thing of like how to fit that, because it's a huge, so much happens.
Well, that's the thing about that copy that I was originally talking about. It's not very good because like the chapters go right into the next chapter on the same page.
Yeah. Yep.
Which feels weird. It doesn't give you that space to breathe. And you also see if you actually spaced it like a normal book, it's 600 pages.
Yeah.
But if you really scrunch it all together and make it impossible to read, it's like, see, 300. Just like,
yeah.
Good, I guess.
Size 10 times New Roman. And you're like, yeah.
Yeah. With all of these phrases, like, and because I have only experienced Dune as a book, I would be referencing things and Sarah would be like, say that again. And I'm still like holding back from pronouncing things because I'm pretty sure I still don't have it right. But there's just so much sci-fi ridiculousness to it, but I can see why. There's just so much to get into. There's so many little details that if you're a nerd for any part of it, you can really grab onto it and think about it. Like the still suits in particular, so fascinating.
And like one of those sci-fi inventions that then comes back around to the real world, where like a moisture wicking still suit is something that exists in the world now. In a way that like, yeah, it probably like we probably would have invented that because people got to figure out how to live in a desert. But there is that thing of like this guy wrote it in whatever 1970 in a way that absolutely like the way that things work in the desert absolutely inspired real technology.
Totally.
Because also all the people who are making the real technology, all a bunch of nerds who read Dune.
65, you know? By the way.
65, good Lord.
Yeah, it's so strange to think that like while Patricia Highsmith was writing another Ripley book, there was also someone imagining the Dune planet of Arrakis.
Arrakis.
Yeah. I also really want to see people surfing on worms. Like that just sounds like really cool and weird.
Yeah. I would say that you could read the next two books. I liked Dune Messiah and Children of Dune when I read them as a teenager. And then I think it was Chapter House Dune. And I was just like, that thing that like the way that time works really starts like just the six books that he wrote take place over millennia.
Jeez.
Which is just like, and it's kind of a wild concept. I mean, he's not the only one. Like the Foundation books that Asimov wrote, he does the same thing.
Yeah.
But there's something that's like, that's tough to swallow.
Mm-hmm.
It's hard enough to jump like a decade, you know?
Well, especially if you're coming in and you get really attached to characters.
Yeah. Yeah. And if while you're waiting for the adaptation, the movie adaptation, Sci-Fi, the network, did a pretty good adaptation. There's the first one, which is just Dune, And then the second one, starring a young James McAvoy as Paul's son, combines Dune Messiah and Children of Dune. And it's like, it's some big sci-fi circa 2000 CGI energy at times. But that's its own kind of particular pleasure if you're looking for that. But it's another fun, like I'm kind of looking forward to having the opportunity to see it in my mind anyway. I have no interest in rewatching David Lynch's Dune. But like to think about the ways in which it's been adapted or attempted to be adapted four times. Because there's also the Jodorowsky Dune that would like wanted Salvador Dali as the god emperor and all sorts of like truly crazy shit.
Yeah, there's some like production stills and things. There's that documentary that I've seen the trailer for. So obviously I'm an expert. that was just like the spaceship design is completely bonkers.
Fucking out of this world insane.
Yeah.
And then I learned that all of that stuff, it was H.R. Giger, who then went on to do the designs for Alien and actually used some of the stuff that he was going to do for Dune for Alien.
Huh, that makes sense.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
All comes together.
So I recommend that new, very gorgeous, it's like Dune Deluxe. If you see it around, it's a really beautiful, and it's the preferable way to read it. Because it was really lush book. You're holding, it's just a nice object to hold as you're deep into Dune.
Nice.
My other recommendation is a movie.
Okay.
It's a little indie flick called Godzilla versus King Kong. My God, I loved it so much. I love Godzilla. I love King Kong. The Peter Jackson King Kong, I saw it three times in theaters. That's how much I love it. And this, I would have really liked to have been able to see this in a theater for realsies.
Yeah.
But it was still awesome at home. And one of the main things that I was thinking about was the canonical King Kong has to climb the Empire State Building. To get to the top of it. But the King Kong in this movie is so much larger. he's the same size as Godzilla, which is not how I thought that they would be matched up. I thought that they would have to do something to make Kong big enough to fight him. If you're looking for that, that doesn't happen. Instead, they're just like, nah, they're the same size. it was fantastic. I haven't stopped thinking about it. I've actually dreamed a couple King Kong versus Godzilla dreams.
Hell yeah.
And so, you know, it's great B-movie energy with enormous production budget.
Mm-hmm.
So fantastic.
I like that all of those, it does something similar to the Ripley books of like the discrete pleasures of each entry and that each like, sure, they've been doing the like building the monster verse or whatever, but that like each one doesn't necessarily need to hang together with the previous, like is Kong the same size in this movie as he was in Kong Skull Island or in the Peter Jackson? It doesn't fucking matter. He's here to fight Godzilla. And so he'll be that size. And if in the next movie, he needs to be smaller, he'll be smaller, you know?
So those are my recommendations. You, what are you recommending?
Two books. I'm going to work backwards. So the first thing I'm recommending is what I read after I read my second recommendation.
Okay.
It's a poetry collection. It's two collections, The Revisionist and The Astro Pastorals by Douglas Crace. The Revisionist came out ages ago, won the National Book Award, and then went out of print. And Nightboat Books brought it back into print with a chapbook of some uncollected poems that Crace had written since. And I really needed like a reset. I needed some space to just like have, I don't know, have brain space, but I still wanted to be reading something. And The Revisionist is one of the most wonderful pieces of poetry I've read in a long time. It's Whitman-esque in the way that it deals with nature and the world. But it's just like, I just fell into it and had a really lovely, refreshing time reading it. And it's sort of one, there are segments within the Revisionist, but it's kind of one long poem. It's a little, in that way, like a little song of myself-y.
Okay. Sounds good.
I really loved it. And Crace was somebody who I had never heard of before. You know, one of those like award-winning authors, poets who sort of falls out of history a little bit for one reason or another. And so it was really lovely. I was sitting out in my yard reading and kind of just like feeling at peace with the world, which is one of the great things about great poetry, the way that it can sort of slow you down and place you back into the world that's around you. And I needed that because I read, and you should all pre-order it immediately, the new Alexandra Kleeman novel, Something New Under the Sun, which is absolutely going to rock your world. It's set, you know, it's one of these like set 10 minutes into the future kind of novels. This writer has flown out to Los Angeles for an adaptation of a book that he wrote. And he's like flying. He's like, I'm the author of the adaptation. Oh, it's going to be so cool. And immediately things start to go south.
Mm-hmm.
It turns out that he's like in his contract, like he's a production assistant and he's like sort of showing up like expecting. And so he's just completely fish out of water. He's from the Northeast and he ends up in LA, and it is an LA that is increasingly on fire, which is true, but also a California that has not only privatized water, but it's a company that's selling water, WAT-R.
Mm-hmm.
And unsurprisingly, if you read You Too Can Have a Body Like Mine, Alex does some like interesting, cool things with playing around with like the capitalism of this. It's a horrifying novel in some ways. It's utterly compelling. It's even better than You Two Can Have a Body Like Mine. And I got to the end of it and was so shaken by it. And so just like it triggered something in my brain that I immediately started rereading it.
Mm-hmm.
Which has only ever happened to me once before, and that was with You Two Can Have a Body Like Mine.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's just something about how Alex writes trips something in my brain. I loved this book so much. I cannot wait to talk about it. And your little hydration pod thingy, when I was reading this book, it's just like, I have such a fear of anything that is... I just had the Culligan man come out to my house because we need to get a new water softener.
Okay.
And he was like talking about like, and we could put in this filter and this filter and this thing. And I was like, nope, no, 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 no. Don't trust it. I got a well and I want my well. And all I want is for the water to be softer. I don't know. I don't trust it. Don't put anything in my water. In a way that I felt a little bit like that about Soylent too, where I'm just like, I don't know about this. Mm-hmm. I don't know about your better water than water. I don't know. And so, you know what? Enjoy it until you read Alex's book. And then I can see it. I'm thinking of you and your apartment, just like there's a glass of water on the table and you look at it and you're like, did I put hydrant in that water? Or is it regular water?
See, I barely ever drink regular water anymore. Ever since getting a Soda Stream, if it's not violent with bubbles, if it doesn't assault me as I drink it, I don't want any part of it.
If every sip doesn't somehow go up your sinuses,
exactly.
Yeah, that feels all right. I think you're okay there.
I want to be physically shook with every sip of water. If it's not freshly seltzed, put it down the sink.
Yeah, so you zhuzh it every time you drink it, huh?
No, I don't do that. I'm inhabiting a character now.
I see.
Yeah, it's character work, you know?
Sure.
Yes, and.
Yes, of course, Dickie.
We both winked at each other. Okay, so that's the podcast, right?
That's it. We've done it.
Everybody at home, go and review us on iTunes. Please do that, actually, for real. Go write us a nice iTunes review. We really appreciate when those nice reviews come in.
You can go to patreon.com/smdb to chip in some money if you'd like. We're going to do our next mailing soon. I won't tell you what it is, but I'm putting it together now-ish. And
that'll be fun.
It'll be yummy.
And we're also going to, we also like to hang with our patrons. So we're going to be announcing more patron hangs soon.
Yeah. Any other questions? You can find us at So Many Damn Books at all the places.
And we'll see you next time in the pages of the books.